Special episode of The Babblery, recorded by Suki Wessling on Martin Luther King Jr. Day 2025. The opening and closing music was performed on the street in front of Bookshop Santa Cruz by Steve Coulter and Bruce Abrams. Steve just happens to be the husband of KSQD's board chair. I didn't know that when I stopped to record them. That's the way we do it in Santa Cruz. Have a cup of coffee with a friend at a locally owned shop, march in community with our friends, neighbors, and complete strangers, and end up listening to music on the street played by a co-volunteer's husband. Thanks to all the women who spoke to me about their feelings on this day. It was hard for me to get myself downtown, but when it comes down to it, community always makes the effort worthwhile. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to The Babblery.
The Babblery is produced with support from KSQD Radio in Santa Cruz, California.
Find us at babblery.com.
Wings thanks all our supporters, including your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen and Genevieve Vaughn, whose books include Women and the Gift Economy, A Radically Different Worldview is Possible. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Welcome to another Film at 11, this time dedicated to one movie alone, and that is Die Hard from 1988. And to walk us through the movie is Josh Afonso, who is in the throes of giving birth to an action film podcast. And this, his chat here will reflect some of his research, but also his absolute passion for the movie, which I share. Hi, Josh.
Hello.
And
good to be here.
So we're here to talk about Die Hard. And how did you first get interested in it?
Well, I would say as a kid, my stepmom was just a big action movie buff.
Oh.
And so these movies are the movies of my childhood. And I've carried that with me.
It's Christmas Eve in L.A.
California.
Is Daddy coming home soon?
Well, we'll see what Santa and Mommy can do, okay?
A New York cop, John McLean, has come to see his wife.
I missed you.
Instead, he's going to have to save her.
Sit down.
Within this skyscraper high above the city, 12 terrorists have declared war.
They're about to be taught a lesson in the real use of power.
They're as brilliant.
Because I am interested in the $640 million in your vault.
As they are ruthless.
But I'm telling you, you're just going to have to kill me.
Okay.
We do it the hard way.
Now, the last thing McLean wants.
Damn it, think.
Is to be a hero.
Where's Holly?
Black Tucker!
Where?
But he doesn't have a choice.
What does he think he's doing?
John. Yeah, okay.
Probably something that I shouldn't have been watching when I was like, you know, as young as I was. But yeah. Well, and then my mom also loves all these movies, and it was just around growing up. It was part of my culture.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Well, tell us about Die Hard. If on by some fluke of fate, an occasional listener won't even know what we're talking about. Yeah, what is a Die Hard?
Well, I came up on some of this in the research, and apparently this is 100% true and came from the mouth of Kevin Smith himself on a podcast I was listening to.
Uh-huh.
That the movie or the book was actually named that way because of the great popularity of the Die Hard batteries.
Oh, that makes sense.
And that's not, apparently that's 100% true. I'm corroborated by someone famous, I don't know.
Well, it was based on a novel, wasn't it? Although the novel had a different title.
Yeah, what was the title again? I couldn't remember. Really told me. I just assumed it was Die Hard.
Something Before Dawn? Or
I have it up right in front of me. Hold on. Based on Nothing Lasts Forever, 1979.
That's right. Nothing Lasts Forever. There were some interesting casting choices at the beginning of the project for Die Hard. The author of the book, Roderick Thorpe, is famous gigantic beach read mystery novels, one of which was The Detective, which became a Frank Sinatra movie not too long after the book was published. And this is a second book by Roderick Thorpe, and he was going to, it was written for with Frank Sinatra in mind, if they were going to make a movie about it. But
right, well, and notable, I think, that he also co-wrote The Towering Inferno, which was a huge success.
That's true too. And he wrote a novel, and another guy wrote a novel, and so the studio just bought both novels and put them together in order to get enough characters for Towering Inferno. I don't know where he is now, but, and I haven't read the novel, so I don't know how accurate the movie is to it, but it probably doesn't matter because they do so much rewriting with...
Well, I actually have some notes on that. So
go ahead.
The movie was actually really written to be sort of a dark Frank Sinatra fights the terrorists noir kind of movie in the late 70s when it was first optioned. Uh-huh. Because of the success of Towering Inferno, it was optioned right away into a movie, Die Hard.
Uh-huh.
So, or I guess the book, Nothing Lasts Forever. And so the Towering Inferno is a big success, and he is now friends with Frank Sinatra because of the movie that they did, or the book, you know, movie they did together.
The Detective.
Yeah, The Detective, thank you. And so yeah, the main character is definitely Sinatra, and it's definitely a dark, like, Frank Sinatra fights the terrorist. Not a lot of jokes, not a lot of quips, not a lot of fun.
Well, so, but if the movie was in development for so long that by the time they got a chance to film it, Frank Sinatra was, what, too old or something? Or he just...
Yeah, he was too old and he wasn't interested in doing it, but he did have right to first refusal.
Oh, that's good.
So, thank you, Frank Sinatra, for turning it down.
Well, what they ended up, the person with whom they made the movie is, of course, we'll get to him in a second, Bruce Willis. But it was designed, the movie was in part a project in which they're trying to make him a movie star after he'd been so popular on television. And he'd been in three or four movies before this, but none of them really caught hold with the public. But when this came out in the summer of, I think it was the summer, maybe the spring of 88.
The year I was born, my friend.
It was a huge success. Well, who else? So what else do we need to know? How much it cost to make? Who else is
in? I think it is extremely notable that it made almost $140 million on about a $35 million budget.
Wow, and they probably saved a lot of money filming it in the Fox Tower, owned by the...
That makes sense. Yeah, I mean, when you think about what a movie like this would cost now, I think even adjusted for inflation, $35 million is a low number. And the lowest number I saw was $25 million, so they were doing fine. Big success.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting that McTiernan wanted to do the movie like Midsummer Night's Dream.
Oh, really?
Which I'm not familiar enough with Midsummer Night's Dream, to be honest, to know what that means necessarily, but I do find it notable.
I'll have to spend some time pondering that, because I don't know what he was thinking. You know, Midsummer Night's Dream is kind of a magical story with lots of lovers coming together in the forest.
I will say that apparently the novel was written as a man who has lost his wife, and this him fighting all the terrorists is so that he can get her back specifically.
Oh, okay. Well, that's woven into the movie. That's in the movie.
Yes, a little bit. I do think it's nice. It makes more sense that they haven't been divorced. You know, I think that the fact that they're still... I ponder this actually myself a lot. Do you think Holly or John McClane was right about who moved where and why? Because I'm kind of on Team Holly here.
I think he's a
little...
He was
bringing in the bread.
He was about bringing in the bread and helping keeping the kids. I think he's a bit of a problem, a troublemaker. You know, a trouble follows him. Of course...
Oh, you mean as a cop?
As a cop, yeah. He just, you know, and I think that... And the movie is like the ultimate version of the sort of thing that she doesn't like to have brought home to her, you know. And she's the first two movies, she's often at the source of in the second one, she's on the airplane that is about to get blown up and so forth. So it's and she disappears from the series after that. He has a daughter, and she appears in subsequent movies, or at least in one of them. But the wife more or less disappears, and we don't know why or where.
Right. I think it's very progressive of this movie to have the woman being the one to pursue her career and leave.
Yeah, that's true.
Especially, I mean, it's 1988.
Anyway,
so the last thing I have that I found notable was that Steven D'Souza was specifically brought in to write the comedy and the one-liners for the movie.
Oh.
So, round of applause for him, because one of the most quotable movies of all time.
There's so many great little touches in this movie from moment to moment. It's like a perfect movie. Everything works. Yes. It just goes like clockwork. It's great to look at. It's a photograph by a fellow named Jan de Bont, who later went on to direct movies himself, such as I think he did Twister.
Love that movie.
Yeah, I like it. But anyway, as they say in Hollywood, 90% of a film is success is casting. And this movie has such a great cast.
They have already killed one hostage.
This channel is reserved for emergency calls only.
There you go,
he
sound like a born a pizza!
He's inside? Who is he?
Who are you then? You are most troublesome for a security guard.
Sorry, wrong guess, huh? Would you like to go for double jeopardy?
Do you really think you have a chance against our sadistic cowboy?
Yippee-ki-yay, mother...
The way that the whole cast sort of had to fall together like puzzle pieces, and how many people could have been in it and weren't in it, and how that would have affected the movie, creates sort of this whole mythos around a movie that's, almost 40 years old, no?
Oh, that's right. Yeah, 88. And that's the reason we're doing the show. We're celebrating a little bit early. It's 40th anniversary.
Yes. Yes. So, the fact that Rickman didn't even want to do the movie.
Oh, yeah.
And essentially spawns a decade's worth of movie bad guys.
That's right.
Accidentally.
And he's so good in the movie. And I think it was his first Hollywood movie. And you suggest then that he's a man from the theater, and he didn't want his first film to be some Hollywood action thing that wouldn't really draw upon his skills. But in fact, his skills, as the way he acts, it really makes the character seem more than just a simple villain, a fully dimensional, competent, really scary fellow. And
intellectual... the fact that he, when he talks about all the terrorist groups that he read about in Time magazine.
Yes.
But that falls into place, and then imitated. I mean, when you talk about Die Hard being a perfect movie and all these pieces coming together to form that,
mm-hmm.
The movie created its own subgenre. The Die Hard in a blank became a thing and still is.
That's right. Yeah. Die Hard in a buck was Speed.
Die Hard in a plane. Die Hard in the president's plane.
He doesn't even have to interact directly with some of the characters, and yet they have relationships. For example, with the patrol cop who finally figures out that there's something weird going on in the building, and then they develop a relationship where doesn't want to use his real name while he's communicating with...
His Roy Rogers while they're communicating.
Yeah, that's right. Well, they have such a great relationship. Yeah, and they're not even they aren't even the same place at the same time. You know, they cut back and forth. But
the true love story of Die Hard is that of Reginald Vell Johnson character and John McClane.
Absolutely,
he says it on the microphone once. He says, "Listen, I love you."
Well,
I love that they don't see each other the whole movie, and then boom, recognize each other immediately at the end.
Absolutely, that's great. I forgot about that.
Yeah, it was meant to be.
American movies are so much better at male love stories than they are at romantic comedies sometimes.
You think they just lean into it and make it more mainstream. Why not?
Yeah, why not? So he's great. There's an actor named Hart Bochner, who is the son of Lloyd Bochner. And he was probably the first of the great long line of sleazy businessman types who are reckless and ruthless at the same time. And
it was sort of a characterization of the sleazy New York business executive, you know?
Yeah.
The coked out 80s business executives.
And he thinks that he's so good, such
so
a great
negotiator.
So smooth. He thinks he's a great negotiator, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you can tell from the character choice. And we should note that it was a 100% Hart Bochner character choice. He had to convince Jewel Silver, who saw him do it in an audition, and said, yep, that's the character, that's what we're going with. So all credit to Hart Bochner, who I don't know really what else he's in, but yeah. So good job by him. But again, like, just really characterizes that stereotype so well. And he's just such a sleazebag. But it's that bravado, right, that gets him into the room.
That's right. It's
that bravado that ultimately gets him killed. And it's all because of that character choice, because if he's playing the straight man next to Bruce Willis, then you have to find a way to get him into the room.
That's true.
I think it's also notable that Stallone dropped out. He wanted a bigger, bloodier movie. And I was ruminating on that. And I think at the time he was sort of in the action movie wars with Arnold, right?
That's true.
The biggest, baddest action star.
That's right.
So it's possible that a more, what would you call this? I mean, I know it's an action movie, but it's sort of like a building thriller, I guess. but it's not really like a, you know, guns a-blazing, body count sort of movie.
It could qualify as a disaster movie, maybe.
Sure.
In that there's a threat to a building through in just not mechanical issues, but by these bad guys.
You just destroyed a building. I am in charge of this situation.
I got some bad news for you. From up here, that look like you're in charge of Jack.
He is alone, he's tired, and he hasn't seen this squat from anybody down here.
Hey, pal, how you feeling?
All things being equal, I'd rather be in Philadelphia.
Only John can drive somebody that crazy.
He's an easy guy to like.
Come out to the coast, we'll get together, have a few laughs.
And a hard man to kill. Bruce Willis, Die Hard.
Got invited to the Christmas party by mistake. Who knew?
Like all the really great popular movies, it's about two or three different movies in one, because it wants to cover a lot of ground to satisfy all general audience members. But fortunately, they didn't use Frank Sinatra, and fortunately, they didn't use Sylvester Stallone, but they did use Bruce Willis. He makes the movie work.
He's the pivot point of the whole movie.
Exactly.
I mean, if you don't end up with Willis in this role, you don't get this movie, and that's a fact. And I struggle. I like to play a game where I like to recast characters, even in a perfect movie like this. And I really can't think of anyone easily who could replace Bruce Willis and do this sort of job and create this sort of character, a legendary character.
I certainly can't think of anybody at the time who could do it and bring that humanity, that ordinary Joe quality, and the his resolve and determination.
I think that he is very uniquely equipped, because I mean, I learned through my research that he was a military brat growing up.
Oh yeah.
So I'm sure that he had some, you know, awareness of how to hold a gun, how to be around guns, all that stuff.
Oh yeah. And maybe
he's also a bartender. So he has that A+ in banter and sort of, you know, cool guy sarcasm.
Uh-huh.
Not that all bartenders have that, but he has it.
Yeah, that's true. He was very popular on a TV show, the title of which is slipping my mind, because everything is slipping my mind. The show was getting made because Cybill Shepherd was in it, but then he became more popular than her, and made that show work, and just naturally assumed that he'd be able to transition to movies, as many other lead actors in television shows have tried to do over time, some with success, some not. They had trouble getting him into a movie that worked. He was in one called Sunset, which is about a guy from the 30s meeting Wyatt Earp in Hollywood while making a movie, And that didn't do too well. And a few romantic comedies that were influenced by the TV shows, you know, will they or won't they kind of romantic entanglement. But this is the one that finally worked. And it's probably because here's the part where he does everything. He's got the romantic angle. He's got the action angle. He's got the wit angle. And I can't think of a single person then or now could bring that to the movie. There are, of course, lots of imitators, but the movies usually aren't quite that good, although some come close.
Well, and we also have the alignment of, you know, so many of these pillars of the action movie genre as far as screenwriters, directors, you know, everyone working on the movie was top of class.
That's right.
And that's why a movie like this can hold up. And then you have Bruce Willis doing sort of this tightrope act through the movie, as you said, filling all these different roles in a way that really no one else can. And it just works. It just works all the way through.
Yeah. Now, it took you a while to see it on the big screen, because your experience of it has mostly been on DVDs. And
I saw it on the big screen for the first time last year. It was fantastic.
Oh, man. Where did you see it?
Over in Gresham, Portland area. And it was in a theater, and it was in just before dinner time, I'd say, you know. But it was the middle of winter, so it was dark. And there was me and two of my buddies, and then two other people in the whole theater. So it was a perfect experience, because I'm not one to shut up when I'm watching this movie. I mean, it's watching this movie is like going to a party.
Yeah.
Well, actually, that's kind of fitting, considering.
Something about the villains in the movie being pretty well sorted through, so that it's just not a bunch of faceless, nameless guys. Each villain has a personality, so that you get involved with what happens to them, or what you don't want to have happen to the Bruce Willis character.
Yes, absolutely. I think that it's interesting too that you pair such a sophisticated villain who sort of has the plan and thought it all out and knows all the people and is well connected and is rich, well funded. You match him against, instead of the jacked up superhero, you match him up against the everyman, the street cop, the beat cop, the guy who's just at a, he just went to a party. He wasn't expecting this. He didn't come in guns a blazing. You know, he has to figure it out. He's frankly getting his butt kicked the whole movie. And you feel for him. You relate to him. And I think there's some part of you that thinks maybe, you know, like that's probably, I could probably do that. Like, you know, or like, you know, I could probably get away with that maybe, you know, he did it.
That's true. That's fantastic.
Yeah. And so it creates such a relatable character that, and then he's funny and he, you know, you get why he's trying to make good with the wife, and he's trying to do all these things, and you want him to succeed.
That's true. Well, we've been talking to Josh Afonso about Die Hard, and it's been great. I love this movie, and it's great to air that love with a fellow admirer of the film.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, full disclosure, I've had it on mute in the background this whole time.
That's fantastic. Well, we'll talk again about another. We'll decide on another film to take a deep dive look at. That's also an action film. And do another episode maybe in a month or so. How's that sound?
Sounds great. Yeah, I'm all in, man. Just let me know.
Okay, will do. All right, thanks, Josh. We'll talk to you later.
All right, Doug, I'll see you later.
Okay. Again, thanks for listening to Community Radio KBOO Portland. Film at 11 will be back next Friday. So until then, please keep watching the screens.
David Barsamian of Alternative Radio, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
International Women's Day is Saturday, March